Amazon is on their buying spree. They can't afford Seattle's head tax, but they can afford to snap up a pharmaceutical company called PillPack for $1 billion. The purchase went through the other day, and just taking a look at what they plan to do, they have decided that they're going to take on companies like CVS and Walgreens. The only problem is that the company that Amazon has purchased gets its drugs from the same company that supplies other pharmaceutical companies. That is AmerisourceBergen, of which Walgreens owns 26%. They were in talks to buy the company outright to try and cut Amazon out. But let's find out how this is going to go with CBS tech consultant Larry Magid. Larry, tell me what Amazon is up to here.
Well, with PillPack, they want to dominate pharmaceuticals, just like they want to dominate everything else. You know, started with books, and they got you with your various gadgets and other products, and now they want to be. Oh, and of course, they bought the big grocery chain, and now they want to dominate
Whole
pharmaceuticals.
Foods. Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose that's a great idea. They might as well do what they're best at. One of the concerns that's been raised is, at what point does Amazon become a monopoly? My understanding is that as big as they are, they're still not close to cornering the market on anything, are they?
Right. I think this is more of a legal question than a tech question, but as I understand it, the whole monopoly thing has to do with vertical versus horizontal, so that if they owned every drugstore or every video outlet or every bookseller, and they practically do own every bookseller, but if they did all of that, then they would be a monopoly in that particular industry. But they can own bits and pieces of all sorts of industries, as I understand it, as long as they don't control any one segment of the industry. But they are getting huge. And by the way, that grocery outlet I'm talking about, of course, is Whole Foods.
Right.
And, you know, I go in there these days and I get a discount if I use my Amazon Prime card. So
See? They
can take advantage of all of that power. So maybe Prime members will get movies and drugs at the same time.
PillPack, this little drug company that they bought, what's their secret? What made them such an attractive buy for Amazon?
As I understand it, you know, mostly from watching their commercials, is what they do is they sort your pills for you. So if you have a number of pharmaceuticals that you order from them, and they come in nice little packages, and of course they come in the mail. And so it's nice and handy in our life, you know, where we get our meals all prefabricated. Now we can get our pharmaceuticals all prefabricated, or at least pre-sorted and packed.
Well, I remember when I used to, when my mom was taking a lot of pills, my sister had to buy one of those containers and
Yep. Sort
them by date. I mean, they tried various systems. She had trouble, obviously, remembering what to take when.
Exactly.
And so, in other words, PillPack basically does that for you. They customize this into little clearly labeled packs so you don't make a mistake when to take
That's my understanding. I'm not one of their customers, fortunately, and if you don't count vitamins.
We all will be eventually, Larry.
Oh, yeah, I guess so, but I don't take that many pills. Other than my wife gives me vitamins, but she organizes them for me. But other than that, and we get those at Whole Foods, so they're going to make our money either way, right? So other than that, I think it just makes life more convenient. And, of course, a lot of people are getting pharmaceuticals delivered. There's a company called Express Scripts, which serves a lot of people, so they don't have to go to the drugstore.
Well, the main thing that attracted Amazon to PillPack, as I understand, is not so much their clever marketing idea, but the fact that they apparently have licenses to operate as a mm-hmm. pharmacy in 50 states.
Right.
So that's a big asset, allowing Amazon to get into that market. But the catch, apparently, is that PillPack has to get its drugs from somewhere, and they get it from the same source as Walgreens does. And, of course, this would be a competitive situation. Would Walgreens then be allowed, because I believe they're thinking about this, to just outright buy the drug source so that they're now a captive company and cut out Amazon from competing with them?
Well, now you are getting into, again, you want to get a legal analyst here, not a tech guy, but now I know you are getting into issues of constraint of trade and monopoly powers and all that kind of stuff. So when it comes to those kinds of situations, my guess is that there would be regulatory issues. And I don't know whether this one is going to be looked at by regulators. I imagine it will be looked at, but I suspect it'll go through. But I think the big question we need to ask ourselves is, how much power should Amazon have over our lives? I'm shocked at how much money I spend. In fact, I guess I'm sending it all up to you guys in Seattle.
Maybe yes, you are.
That's probably why you put me in the air.
The left sphere is named after you at the Amazon complex.
It should be. But, you know, it's amazing how much I spend on Amazon versus how much I spent on any other retailer I've ever shopped at over the course of my life.
Yeah. Well, they make it easy, and pretty soon the stuff will arrive like in 5 minutes
before you order it. They'll anticipate your needs.
Exactly right. Yeah. Larry Magg, CBS Tech Consultant. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
For the second time this year, a nerve agent has affected people on British soil. We think it's accidental, but joining us to explain what we know, here's CBS's Larry Miller, live from London. Larry, tell us about this latest incident.
Well, we know that two people, an average British couple, Charlie Rowley and his partner, Dawn Sturgis, became violently ill, started passing out on Saturday, and were taken to the hospital. At first, the authorities thought it was a drug overdose, but then they did tests and they found that they were suffering from exposure to Novichok, which is a nerve agent developed by the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s. That's what contaminated the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal on his daughter Julia 4 months ago, exactly back in March in Salisbury, England. These people came from a little town, Amesbury, about 10 miles from Salisbury. Friday night, they took a bus into Salisbury. What did they do there? Well, they did normal everyday things, but did they come in contact with something, a syringe, a container, that sort of thing? Because that's what the authorities and the government is saying here, that that's really how they probably were contaminated. And the British are blaming the Russians. The Russians say, we didn't do it the first time and we haven't done it this time, and stop bothering us about it. So that's where we are. These people are in critical condition in Salisbury Hospital. They're fighting for their lives.
Wow. This is, first of all, not to get too graphic, but to get graphic, they were frothing at the mouth, hallucinating, and incoherent, according to this report in the Washington Post. Now, the fact that, and so the theory is they just came into casual contact. And in other words, nobody actually approached them and stuck a needle into their leg or sprayed them with something. They apparently just took something that had been lying around.
That seems to be the theory right now. They, as I said, they're just an average English couple. The nerve agent, you're absolutely right. In fact, what happened was the woman was taken to the hospital first, and then the man, the partner, and a friend of his went into town. They went to a pharmacy to fill a prescription, and then on the way back, he got sick, started foaming at the mouth, started shaking, dribbling, making no sense. Because what this does is within minutes, it can affect breathing, cause paralysis and body functions to cut out. And it can be inhaled, but it can seep through the skin. And that could be what happened here. But
and apparently
again,
it never degrades?
Don't know. It never degrades. No, I mean, it might take years and years and years to degrade. And so what happened after the Skripals were contaminated and they went to the hospital, the British decontaminated all the areas they could find that the Skripals had been to before they collapsed on that bench outside a shopping center. Mm. And these people didn't go near any of those areas. That's the kicker here.
Oh,
they didn't go anywhere that the Skripals had gone to. So did someone who had smeared it on their door, the Skripals' door, then dump it somewhere else, and that's where these people became contaminated.
Yikes! So for people who live in that area of England, what are they doing? They're wearing gloves, wearing masks. What are they doing?
Well, the health department here is playing down the level of risk. It's very it'll be very unusual for someone to come in contact with it. Mm-hmm. But the security minister this morning said it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Yeah. He says, and this is what is upsetting people. He said there can be no guarantee at this point that people will be 100% safe. So if you're, out there, if you're in Salisbury or Amesbury, anywhere near there, you've got to be very careful. And Public Health England said, look, if you think that you come in contact, wash all your clothes, boil your clothes, wipe down anything that may have come in contact with it. But that doesn't really make people feel any better.
No. CBS's Larry Miller joining us live from London. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Oil prices have spiked. They have hit their highest point since 2014. The president was on Twitter asking OPEC, please, please, please reduce the cost of oil. Some of it was in all caps, which ought to get OPEC moving. Meanwhile, the president's sanctions against Iran are pending, which means Iranian oil will be restricted on the international market. So to tell us what that might mean for us when it comes time to buy gas, let's talk with Richard Nephew, who is the principal deputy coordinator for sanctions policy at the Department of State, was also the lead sanctions expert for the U.S. team that negotiated with Iran, and author of a book called The Art of Sanctions. So first of all, twittering at OPEC, it's coming from the president of the United States, and we know that he makes good on his threats to slap tariffs on people. So has that had any effect?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, it's demonstrating to OPEC, it's demonstrating to the Saudis in particular what our concerns are. And the fact that the Saudis arguably have got as much interest as anyone in putting pressure on the Iranians, I think there's an implicit quid pro quo that's being laid out there. You know, if you want us to go after Iran, you need to help us out on oil prices. But will it actually help prices go down? I strongly doubt it, especially because there's a very real concern that it's a market issue as opposed to a speculation issue on the part of the Saudis.
Okay, a market issue. We're seeing oil now at $73. Not too long ago, it was down around 50. So what changed?
Well, I think a couple of things changed. First, you know, we do have a real situation in Venezuela with concerns over how much oil is going to be coming out of that country. The fact it's been going down over the course of the last couple of years due to the political turmoil there, I think, is very real. The same thing with Libya. And there's a concern about supply disruption coming out of there. I think that a good part of it comes from increased security concerns, though, in the Middle East. And the fact that the United States walked out of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement with Iran, has definitely raised security concerns. But so, too, as you're alluding to, has the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iranian oil exports are coming back online.
So we should have been prepared for this, then, is what you're saying.
A little bit. I tend to think we ought to look ahead of the road before we start pressing down the accelerator. And I certainly think that the president's now starting to be told, hey, if we start taking Iranian oil exports down to zero, yeah, this is only the start of oil prices going up.
I mean, Venezuela has been a slow-moving train wreck. We knew that was happening. Libya is a continuing train wreck. We knew that was happening. So nobody factored those two oil-producing nations into the mix when deciding let's go full speed ahead against Iran?
Well, this is one of my big concerns about sanctions, frankly, is that all too often the people ordering their execution don't think through the second and third tier implications of them. And I think that this is especially the case with Iran, that to some extent we may have made it look easy in 2012 and 13 because oil prices didn't go up. Yeah. When we imposed our original sanctions there, too. But the world has changed a lot in those 6-7 years.
Now, I think, though, the supposition was that, hey, with fracking, once the oil price goes up and it becomes very lucrative to frack again, that this will solve itself. I mean, I know that there was some concern that some of the fracking operations, once oil had dropped far enough, I mean, this is a pretty expensive process, were no longer profitable, and so they were backing off. But now with oil up at $73 a barrel, it becomes more cost effective to do that, doesn't it?
It does. But then there's the question of lead time and how long it takes to get the rigs up there again to start drilling wells and to start getting oil exported, and then extracted. And then how do you get it out of the fields of North Dakota and into export markets? And that's where additional pipelines and trucks and trains and all those various other different bits of infrastructure come in. So the real problem with fracking as a spare capacity, outlet is the question about whether or not you can do it quickly. And that's where the Saudis and other places have always been seen as a much more reliable source of spare capacity, because to some extent it's a on or off switch. That you don't have that really with what's going on in fracking. It takes a lot longer for production to catch up. And that's, again, assuming that you can even get production to match what the Iranians would potentially be foregoing with 2.4 million barrels per day of exports.
Yeah. So the president's tweet, all caps, reduce pricing now, aimed at OPEC. So you can't just reduce pricing. I mean, that means Saudi Arabia and other countries have just decided to pump more oil, which I believe they can do, right?
They can. But there is a very real question about can they pump enough? And especially this goes back to the question of Iran sanctions. You know, back in the heyday of Iran sanctions, we still had the Iranians exporting around 1 million barrels per day of oil. But the State Department just said that we should get them down to zero. Well, there isn't 2.4 million barrels per day of spare capacity anywhere in the world, at least not to any expert that I've talked to. And so from that perspective, if we are truly intending on driving Iran to zero, that is going to have an increased pressure on prices. It just has to. That's you know, laws of supply and demand.
How high could it go if they don't cooperate?
Well, I mean, back in 2010 through 13, we had prices at, you know, $110 to $120 a barrel. Yep. I don't think it's crazy to assume that it could go up as high as that again, especially because the crises in Venezuela and Libya don't look like they're on the improving side of things. In fact, No. You could argue that they're going to get much worse before they get better.
Exactly. Richard Nephew, the author of The Art of Sanctions. Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. It's finally coming down. In a couple of months, we're talking about the Alaskan Way Viaduct being demolished to make way for a new waterfront boulevard, and to know what to expect and how to get around, here's Tracy Taylor.
Only a few short months away from the Highway 99 Alaskan Way Viaduct shutdown. Now, before the scheduled closure this fall, there's still a lot of work to do. Seattle Tunnel Partners have completed building the roads, finished the electrical rooms and systems to make the tunnel function. Program Administrator Brian Nilsson from the Tunnel Project tells us what's next.
Tunnel construction work is basically complete. However, there's literally thousands of pieces of equipment that go into the tunnel to direct traffic and manage the safety systems, ventilation and fire suppression and the like. So Seattle Tunnel Partners, our contractor that has constructed the tunnel, is in the process of testing and commissioning that equipment. Last week, we did the first test of the Deluce sprinkler system inside the tunnel. Over the course of 2 minutes, 6,400 gallons of water poured out onto the sprinkler heads onto the roadway.
Highway 99 is an alternate route for many who want to avoid the mess on I-5. So when you take that away, it leaves you with limited options. As we've learned from the past, does fish truck, crab truck, box truck mean anything to you? When you lose a major artery into downtown, it puts added pressure on I-5, which puts added pressure on surface streets like First Avenue, Fourth Avenue, and Airport Way South. Now, those are not the only routes that will suffer. Both directions of 405, I-90, and the West Seattle Bridge will feel the effect of this looming closure. Brian explains some of the ramps will also have to close before the upcoming closure of Highway 99.
In order to open the tunnel of traffic, our first step is to realign the highway, remove the detours, and direct Highway 99 north and south of the tunnel into the tunnel. In order to do that, we're going to have to close mainline Highway 99 for a period of about 3 weeks. We will have to close off-ramp to Atlantic Street. That ramp is planned to close about a week before the start of the mainline closure. Transition into the tunnel is complete, and we've opened tunnels of traffic. The northbound off-ramp to Alaskan Way, that ramp is going to continue to be closed for a week or two after Highway 99 has moved into the tunnel.
Now, drivers adjusted their routes for the closure of Highway 99 back in April of 2016 for the Bertha tunneling. And now it's never too early to start planning your commute strategy. At least that's what DOT wants you to start thinking. Now might be the time to put the bug in your employer's ear on changing schedules or maybe working from home. Consider taking Sound Transit or King County Metro. Drivers I've spoken with took vacation when the last closure happened and are planning on doing the same thing this time around. I've linked up the latest tunnel project progress report from DOT and what to plan for when this closure happens this fall at MyNorthwest.com. Tracy Taylor, Cairo Radio, real-time traffic.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here is Danny O'Neill. So the Mariners winning streak ends at how many?
Eight.
Eight. That's pretty good.
It is pretty good. And it was a very fun game yesterday. They gave an admirable effort, even though they came up short. Bases loaded, no outs in the bottom of the seventh, no runs. They were threat to score in the ninth, too, and just couldn't really put a dent into it.
You missed your sweep call because there was another sweep while you were gone, so I had to make up for it.
Kansas City Royals on Monday. She did very well. She put her heart into it. What she lacked in technique, she made up for with effort.
But it was sorely missed, Dave. I mean, we were
It was back-to-back sweeps.
Yeah.
That's really...
right?
You didn't even
have to tell people to get out the broom because they already had it out from the previous sweep.
Well, that's what I do now. I now have a broom in every area I need to sweep. I just leave it there. So I don't have to get it out anymore.
Got a little pocket broom just in case you're on the road.
I guess I would change it to pick up the conveniently located broom and dustpan grandma. It's sweep time.
Yes, which we do twice a week.
We'll get back at it. I mean, what? This is one loss. We had an 8-game winning streak. I'm feeling good.
That's exactly
still
right.
Still feeling good.
All right, to the NFL. What did Mike Freeman? Mike Freeman called this. What did he call this? This is potentially one of the biggest rule changes in the history of football, this new helmet rule. So what's your evaluation? And first of all, explain what it is and why it's such a big deal.
They are forbidding head-to-head contact, the lowering of the helmet. If a player, while making a tackle, lowers his helmet, in any situation, it's technically a penalty. That's how they've changed the verbiage.
Just lowering the helmet or lowering it and making contact?
Yeah, lowering it in anticipation of contact. That would be the actual rule is, so looking toward contact and taking and just rotating your head down. So instead of, they refer to the hairline of the helmet, which is kind of where the face mask meets the tip and the crown. So moving, tilting the crown of the helmet forward.
Goodness gracious.
Is a rule. And
who do you call it against? Because typically don't both guys lower their helmets at the same time if they're about to collide?
Yes.
It's like a reflex.
Correct. And that's why Mike Freeman called it the most important rule change. Now the question is enforcement. Do they use this to enforce and to say that any person who lowers their helmet in anticipation of contact, Is that a penalty? Are they going to throw the flag? I don't think that that's practical because you're probably going to see that happen 30 to 40 times a game at least.
The game would stop dead.
And so the next question is, do they just do it for if the helmet is lowered in a large, like a huge hit? Is that when they do it? And it's a continuation of they provided a protection for receivers who are making a catch. You can't lower your helmet to hit that guy while he's making a catch. This is an extension of that protection to any player, that you can't lower your helmet in anticipation of contact, thinking that that will take the velocity and the violence out of some of these hits.
Are we getting to the point, like with the catch rule, what counts as a catch, what counts as a bad hit? Are we getting to the point where we're getting too down to the nitty-gritty and it's ruining the game?
Depends on who you ask, yes.
With a caveat of, I want players protected because I understand the seriousness of
that. And that's kind of the thing that I don't know if you can do both. I don't know if you can like football and not want any players to get injured. Like, I think that there is, or to try and think that rules like this. The problem I see with this rule is twofold. The first is that it shifts the onus, and this is the continuation of the NFL's attempt to shift the onus for the injuries that result in this game. The head injuries come from the way the players play it, not the game. It's because the players are so violent. Because the players lower their helmets going into collisions, that's why the game and players have CTE and get head injuries. There's no evidence to point to that. The players get injured because football's a full contact game.
These are big guys.
That's why it happens. The second problem that I have is this idea that you're legislating out of liability protection, and that, see, we're trying to make the game safe.
So this is just for the lawyers.
Correct.
You don't think this is actually going to be enforced? How could you enforce it?
I don't think that you can. I certainly not at the, or you just sit there and say, which is kind of what they did before, which is, we're going to try to take the most outrageous hits out. We're going to try to take the biggest hits out of the game. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is another tool in that, and you can do it. I've always maintained, if you really want to make the game less violent, if that's really the goal,
take the helmets off, right?
Yeah.
Remove the face mask.
That's what I keep. Oh, remove the face mask.
Even that would be enough. Mm. Because if you had players who couldn't, right now, you're kind of a protected missile. You can just turn yourself into it. If you had to worry about your face making contact, you would take the rugby, and this would be the study that's worth doing. Does rugby have fewer incidents of CTE? Is that a safer sport? It's not a contact sport, but it's not a full speed contact sport.
Do they not study rugby? Is that not happening right now?
I haven't seen any. I think that they've got to, and maybe that you don't have the same volume of players mm-hmm. that have come through and played at that level. But that would be the question to me, because if that's the goal, is to eliminate the amount of brain damage that players suffer, which is a noble intention, the next question is, because there's not a lot of evidence that would point to the fact that it's the big concussive hit that actually causes the damage.
So are they going to change the training regimen then?
Yeah, they're going to change. And the Seahawks have been doing this for a while, of like tackling differently. The Seahawks teach what they call the hawk tackle, which removes the head from the tackle. Right. And you're supposed to tackle with your shoulder.
But if some teams do that, if they don't enforce it, don't you become a sucker team then if you play by the rules and the other teams, because there's no enforcement, decide not to?
Yes. Yes, you would. Yeah. And it becomes, but that's the, I don't think you can teach a different style of tackling. And as great as it is how the Seahawks do things, you still have players, because you're trying to stop a guy that's coming at you at full speed. And I think it's a natural reaction that you're going to lower your helmet. You lower your helmet a little bit.
Danny O'Neill, our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Welfare reform, another conservative idea the Trump administration has enthusiastically adopted. Robert Rector with the Heritage Foundation is the man behind many of the Republican welfare reform plans. He's been working on it since the Reagan administration. He is the original author of the welfare work requirements that were passed on a compromise between the famous compromise between Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton back in 1996. And President Trump now wants to expand that, as well as overhaul the various federal welfare entitlement programs. So the question for Robert Rector is, what exactly does the president think he can change about the current system?
Well, I think there are sort of three themes here. The one that's current now is their recent proposal to move the food stamp program into USDA and to begin to integrate the overall system of aiding poor people. The problem with that is that the federal government runs about 90 different programs designed to assist low-income people at a cost of altogether of $1.1 trillion, and that does not include Social Security or Medicare. Now, conservatives like to call these programs means-tested welfare, but you could also just call them programs that aid low-income people. They're programs that provide cash, food, housing, medical care, and social services targeted to, say, the lowest income one-third of the population. And this is an enormous system. We're spending about $6 out of every $100 in our economy on this system. And it's spread over 10 different government departments, many of whom don't know what the other departments are mm-hmm. doing. It's a completely fragmented system. And quite literally, we have little control or understanding of how much is being spent. We don't understand what recipients get. If you were to go to any individual in the welfare office there in your city and say, what did this family get from the aggregate system of aiding poor people last year? They don't know, and they can't tell you because of the fragmentary nature of this program, of these programs. And the programs don't meet larger objectives of promoting self-help, self-sufficiency, of promoting upward social mobility. They work at cross-competing purposes, really don't do a good job either from the perspective of the taxpayer or from the perspective of the recipient. So President Trump would like to bring those programs together, move food stamps out of the Agriculture Department, which is really a department for farmers, run by farmers, and who don't understand aiding the poor very well, bring that together in HHS, and then also form a council where all of these programs come under an integrated policy oversight and policy development in a way that's coherent. Because when we're looking at the welfare system in the United States, virtually no one is getting assistance from just one program. Families are typically getting aid from six or seven programs at the same time, and we need to think about that in a holistic way.
Wasn't your 1996 reform supposed to fix that?
No, see, that's the problem. That's right on there. Because, in fact, in 1996, what we reformed was only one of these 90 programs. We reformed a program that was used to be called Aid to Families with Dependent Children.
Right.
It's now called Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. But almost no family just got aid from that program. They also got aid from Medicaid and from food stamps and from something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is really a large cash grant program that goes to families through the Treasury Department, of all things, through the IRS, which is not coordinated with the other programs. And so we reformed one program, and then members of Congress said, oh, well, we ended welfare. No, they just modestly modified one program, leaving the other 90 untouched. The principle of welfare reform 20 years ago was that able-bodied adults who get assistance from the government should be expected to work or prepare for work as a condition of getting that aid. But in fact, it's almost completely absent across the span of these 90 different programs. We'll give you some leads.
I thought we did that now. I mean, in this state we have, I think they call it WorkSource or something like that, where you have to go in every week and prove that you at least tried to get a job.
No, and in that type of doing it doesn't do much of anything. That really exists only for this program, TANF, okay? Mm-hmm. It does not exist for food stamps, and it does not exist for housing. And in the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is, you would think, well, that's for earned income, right? No, yeah. Because it's on the honor system. If you say you had a job in earnings, we just say, okay, you did. We never verify whether you did or not. So, in fact, a work requirement is almost completely absent from the welfare system, even in the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program. As we speak right now, half of the able-bodied caseload is completely idle. They're not doing anything. So that's one of Trump's initiatives, is to reinvigorate these work requirements, apply them across all of these programs for able-bodied people that are capable of working. And when you do that, what you find is, miraculously, a large number of people are no longer interested in getting those benefits, in part because there's a whole lot of off-the-books earnings in low-income communities, gray market activity, and a very typical thing is to have a hidden, unreported job at the same time you're claiming these benefits. Well, if you put a work requirement onto that type of program, the person that has the unreported job can't be two places at once, and so they tend to drop off the rolls. That's good for society. It's good because we don't want to reward people for being dishonest. And it enables us to focus our resources and energies on those people who really don't have a job, really can't support themselves.
Now, will any reform this extensive get through Congress? Because you will have, at some point, somebody say, you're going to starve the children. So how do you politically get something like this adopted?
The main thing is just for the Trump administration and for the conservatives in Congress to pick these ideas up. If you take an approach that you're going to merge compassion with the poor with a requirement of fairness, which is, we will help you, but we don't want you to cheat on us, and we want you to do something to help yourself, there's almost no one who really objects to that, except on the very, very far left. And so there's the problem is that essentially Republicans 20 years ago turned around and told their base that they had ended welfare, when in fact almost the entire welfare state was still sitting there utterly unreformed, such as the food stamp program. And they need to pick up that idea again, which really originated with President Reagan way, way in the, you know, prehistoric ages back then. And this is a very popular theme. I do believe that President Trump really is motivated by these ideas, really does believe that the system needs reform, and really actually believes that the system has failed the poor, and that these sorts of ideas of self-help and of promoting marriage and of integrating these programs so we understand them better will benefit everybody.
Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. We talk a lot about the homeless and drug crisis in our state. It can be heated. It can involve a lot of negativity and bad feelings. But this time we want to share some positive news about some people getting their lives back on track with the help of a nonprofit in Snohomish County. And actually, Hannah Scott, you've been following Snohomish County's progress in the opioid and the homeless crisis up there. They're actually one of the leaders in the state. So this doesn't surprise me. They're making progress.
And this is not the county itself. This is a nonprofit in Snohomish County. So for the past 5 years, the Hand Up Project has been helping people living on the streets and dealing with addiction get their lives back on track. The nonprofit is run by Robert Smiley, a recovering addict who has a half dozen sober homes, some with as many as 36 beds, and several trailers. They do daily outreach, going into wooded areas where encampments have been set up and other spots with large numbers of homeless people. And they ask them what they need to develop a relationship with them, offering them everything from a meal or a ride to the doctor to a pack of smokes or a place to live if they're ready to kick the drugs. And one of the big keys to their success, the fact that those who've been through drug addiction and homelessness and helped by this program are the ones out there doing that daily outreach. It helps people in the throes of addiction relate, and they think, hey, if this person got their lives back, maybe so can I.
So the people in this nonprofit are also recovering and also, what, formerly homeless too?
Some of them are formerly homeless. Some of them were just addicted for a long time. Some of them lost their kids. They've been through this in one way or another, and they can identify. And that's exactly what happened with Chris more than a year ago. He had just done a year in county jail after more than 20 years of meth addiction. He had been clean for 2 weeks, and he was sleeping on a pallet behind a Home Depot in Everett where there was an outreach effort.
And I started talking to a couple of his program members, and I was like, look, if I'm not off the streets tonight, it's over. I cussed him out when they brought Robert over to me, and he's like, I can put you in a house. I can do this. I can do that. It's like, no, you can't. Nobody's going to do that for a struggling addict.
But they did. And Chris, who managed to stay clean for those 2 weeks prior to this, after getting out of lockup and was just hours away from using again that night, he said, he instead moved into a room at one of the Hand Up Project sober homes. 13 months later,
I just had my first overnight with my daughter last night, who's 2.5, who I lost because of my addiction through CPS. Looks like in 9 months, my case will be completely closed and my daughter will be at home with me. Because of Robert and his wanting to give me a hand up.
But he had to do the work, which includes working, having a job, staying clean this whole time, and being part of that outreach team to try to help others do the same.
Oh, so that's required of this program, too, that you then... Oh, that's new. That's good.
Yeah, it's a big part of the success, according to the organizer, Robert Smiley, who runs the Hand Up Project. And Chris did all of that, and then this past weekend, he moved into a place of his own, where he plans to focus on rebuilding his relationship with his kids.
My other daughter, who I'd lost to CPS due to my addiction, said, I heard you were clean. I want to see you. I hadn't seen her in 6 years because I was constantly in and out of jail and high.
Wow, wow, wow. So what do you think was different about Chris's story? Because you do hear this where somebody goes, okay, I'll accept the help. They get it. They go back. And they relapse and they come back and it's this revolving door. Whereas Chris that night was ready and successful at this program.
So it can absolutely be the mindset. He said to me that he was for 2 weeks out there living on this pallet. He'd been out of county jail for from a year term that he spent in there for about that 2 weeks. And he didn't want to use again, but nothing was going his way. For some reason in that 2 weeks, he started to give up. There was a needle. So they also go out and they give needle exchanges out at some of these things. They do food, right? They hand out food to people and they give needles. He went to get needles first, and that's how he got talking to some of these outreach people. They hooked him up with Robert Smiley, the organizer, and like he said, he cussed him out. He was like, you're not going to help me. You're not going to do this. I'm just ready to give up. Forget it. He's like, I got a place for you to stay tonight, so let's do that. So we did that. He met other people then, because you go back to the sober home where there's other people going through this,
peer,
different levels.
Yeah.
They're not all newbies. And they're going through the program. And
it reminds me of Alcoholics Anonymous, where you do have that peer group, whereas this, yes, they're dealing with addiction too, but also with homelessness and having that peer relatability with homelessness apparently is key as well.
It made all the difference for him, and he's got his life back. He was so excited, moved in this past Sunday, and is definitely focused on getting those daughters back with him. He should have his youngest daughter back after supervised visits in about 3 months, he said.
Wow, good to hear.
That is a great story. And we don't hear enough of them, I assume, because it's very difficult to do. But, I mean, would you, I mean, the guy she was talking to was right. Who would take someone like that? And
well, I think that's the thing. Is based on this story, what I've sort of come to the conclusion of is that somebody like you and I, who's never dealt, well, that I know of, Dave, for me personally speaking, if you haven't dealt with homeless, if you don't know what it's like to be addicted, we will never be compassionate enough to stick by these people and solve the crisis. So the more organizations and people who have been through it and can give that peer-to-peer relationship from somebody on the streets, that's how we're going to solve it. It's not going to come from people who mean well like you and I.
Right.
Who,
I wouldn't know where to begin.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I give money. But I tried one-on-one prison ministry once, and
It probably didn't
clue.
Work for them either because
exactly.
they can't relate to you. They need to talk to somebody who's been through it. And that's true in any instance in life, parenthood, a medical condition, anything. You need to find that person who's been through it too. Otherwise, how do you get through to the other end?
Yeah, that's a good point.